If you're enjoying this podcast, please leave us a review and tap the follow button so that you never miss an episode.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another Monday. You know what that means? It's time for another episode of RFRX, your prescription for coping. I'm Kara. I'll be your host. And I have with me this evening returning co-host who is fine now. Rob, how are you doing?
I'm doing just fine. You can hear that. A thunderclap behind me. So Anthony and I are under thunderstorm alerts and even tornado watches. So just great. Hopefully I don't have to turn my video off and run.
Yes, we hope that as well for your own safety. But obviously, if you do have to do that, either of you, please do. Safety first. Go into your basement with your mattress or whatever your safety plan is.
Yeah, at least I have a basement. My sister lives in a Tornado Alley in Oklahoma, and no basements. And she actually has to do the lie in the bathtub with a mattress over her thing. It's unbelievable.
Yep, that's what we do in Texas, or at least that's what we did in my family. I don't know if that's what everyone does, but yeah, that's a little scary. So hopefully it passes by y'all without any incident. But by all means, keep us updated on the goings on. Yikes. So yeah, that's exciting, not in a good way. But anything else going on lately with you, Rob, that you'd like to share? Interviewed any other celebrities recently?
Oh yeah, for people who didn't hear me last year, just last week, just before the RFRX last week, I had interviewed Richard Dawkins. And so I submitted it probably 4 days ago and they haven't published it yet. I was hoping it was gonna be out today, but it might be out tomorrow, but yeah.
Awesome.
That was like an amazing thing because it was really hard to reach him and the emails went to like into cyberspace and I never came back. And finally the person who runs the whole thing said, well, let me reach out to him. And he put us together and it worked out. Last year's equivalent was Neil deGrasse Tyson. That was like,
That's so cool. Yeah. Let us know when that comes out. I want to read it, listen to it, watch it. Awesome. Okay. So now, without any further ado, I guess that was a little bit of ado. Now, no more ado. Rob, I'm sure I'm not using that word correctly, but would you like to introduce our guest?
Sure. So Anthony is an RFR ambassador and a support group leader. And he was diagnosed as autistic at age 51. He is an IT professional by day, a veteran of the US Air Force, and has had various other side jobs, such as, I never thought I'd say this, opera singer, film score composer, singer-songwriter. I don't usually know people who have those jobs. He was born in Philadelphia and has lived most of his life in nearby Camden County, nearby to me, New Jersey, where he currently lives with his wife. Welcome, Anthony.
Hey, welcome Hello. To the program.
Opera singer? Hey. Oh, my
yeah,
God.
Yeah, long story that, but yeah, I did my first professional opera gig when I was in high school. And then when I served in Germany, there was an opera house that said, hey, do you like come sing opera? And I'm like, sure. They go, okay, give us your financial information. I'm like, why? She goes, you get paid for this. I'm like, I get paid for this?
What?
So, yeah, I got a part-time job singing in operas when I was in Germany, was stationed in Germany.
Did you have to wear the cool Viking hats with the horns?
No, sadly, no.
You know, we're already getting requests in the chat for you to do a song later in the program or the hangout, perhaps.
Perhaps. Yeah, no, my voice is nowhere near where it used to be. So anyway, all righty. Hello. Well, thanks for everybody for coming by and having this. This is my first RFRX talk. Kind of excited, kind of nervous. So happy to move along with this. So I want to introduce myself first a little more rather than the bio that I give. I just have a couple of things I want to cover beforehand. First of all, the autism community doesn't exist in a vacuum, obviously. It exists within the larger sphere of the disability rights community. There are a lot of people who very much are, you know, in natural allies against people who, against things, the rights of disabled people either being ignored or in some cases actively attacked. So that's just something that we do. I will use the term autistic person to refer to myself and to other people. There's a big debate, never been resolved as far as I can tell in the disability community, of whether to use identity first language or person first language. Autism community, I believe, does have a more prevalence for identity first language, because most of us who can express such thoughts can actually do feel like this is something which is central to who we are. It is not something we have caught or that happened to us. So, it's very much a part of who we are. As was mentioned, I was an opera singer. I have tons of different things that I have tried and all kinds of things. I was diagnosed when I was 51 years old. My wife, who follows Gary Newman's wife on Twitter, was reading some stories about her brother who's on the spectrum and how she told her husband, Gary Newman, that he might be on the spectrum. And she turned to me and she said, "Have you ever thought?" And then it began. I found somebody to do my diagnosis as an adult, which is difficult to do. Even now, it's been it's been 9 years. It's difficult now, and I'll talk a little bit about that, about how what we talk about in the autism community. We talk about falling off the cliff, because for some reason, for the longest time in the United States, autism was thought of something that just kind of goes away when you reach puberty. It's never stated, but like all of the services basically are for children 16 and under. That's it. Even the gold standard for autism diagnosis is preferably done on children that are no more than 5 or 6 years old. I forget what the test is actually called, but you put the child in a social situation and you observe their behavior, and that's how part of the whole thing. When you get older, obviously that doesn't work, because when I enter a group full of toddlers, they tend to sort of have one of two reactions, neither one of which seems friendly. So they have to go to other ways. There are other ways to do it, and we'll cover that too. So let me, first of all, let's give away the answer to our poll card. Can we see the poll results? Do we have that?
Yes, let me go ahead and put those back up. Here we are, sharing the results. And
That first one is just a survey question. Yeah. I thought, okay, that's cool. The correct answer for the percentage is currently 3%. So I have here, hold on, let me get to my, I'm going to share a screen of mine. And I'm going to pull this up. And Rob, this answers a question you had earlier about how this was actually reached. I looked it up while we were getting ready.
Yeah, that was in the pre-show, so people won't know what you're talking about.
Yeah. So Rob is saying, where did you get this number? And is it a number of total people? Is it a number of people who are diagnosed, who are seen, which is what I thought, but it wasn't. It's actually the data on statistics on autism spectrum disorder. This is kept by the CDC. In the US, so obviously it's only US, through what they call the Autism and Developmental Disabilities Monitoring Network. So now here, I'm going to share my screen here. Hold on a second, see if this works. Yes, there we go. Here's the website that I went to. And if you'll see something interesting about this chart, can y'all see this?
Yep.
Yes.
Okay, cool. You go from 1 in 150 in 2000 all the way to 2020, it's 1 in 36. That's where we get our 3% from. Ooh. Now, why is this happening? And the other thing I want to point out is that these are official diagnoses. There are people who self-diagnose or who highly suspect that they may be on the spectrum. And in certain circumstances, that's perfectly valid. If you want to identify and be part of the community, that's fine. But this is specifically talking about people who have been clinically diagnosed.
Jump in real quick though. Oh, sorry. Sure. We all talked at once. I was just going to mention for anybody that is listening, we have some people that listen only. So for the visual descriptions or for the visuals, sometimes it helps to provide a description. So I was just going to mention.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Thank you for that. Yeah. This is a chart which basically shows the surveillance year, talking about the birth year of children and, and when they were, and there's a column for surveillance year, which is the year they were tested. The year they were born, and the number of sites that are reporting. And so this is a network of sites that basically report on autism diagnoses throughout the country. And what we have is we go from a 1 in 150 from back in 2000 and 2002, 125 in 2004, 2006 is 1 in 110, 2008 is 1 in 88, 2010 is 1 in 68. And in fact, I still believed that that was the last statistic I had seen. So I'm kind of way out of date. Then there's 1 in 69 in 2012, 2014, 1 in 59, 2016, 1 in 54, 2018, 1 in 44, and 2020, which is the latest that they have here, is 1 in 36.
Yeah, so my question, before we started this officially, when you just talked about what you're going to talk about, and I had the question was, does this reflect some sort of a selection bias that people bring people who are close, they think maybe they have autism, and then they get checked, oh yeah, they do. And you don't bring people who don't. So does that play into this to extrapolate it to the general population?
Well, it probably does, simply because they're using this network that is part of the CDC to, so you would have to have somebody who would know to do this. And you have to have the parents or guardians, whoever, who can actually afford to do this, because a lot of times this is not actually covered, depending on the circumstances. So yeah, but but beyond that, I can't answer that. I don't know. I'd have to look more into it. I would be really surprised if it was that high among the general population, but by the same token, maybe not, because there is this, one of the reasons why the rates keep going up is because there are still, the diagnostic criteria are more well known. The early detection is implemented in a lot more places, and excuse me. And we're just getting better about hopefully accepting this, and rather than hiding it. Gary Newman was actually diagnosed when he was young, but his parents basically didn't like the diagnosis. They sent him for the treatments that they wanted to give him back at the time. Again, this is like the 1960s we're talking about, but they hit it and they really didn't like it. They pulled him out of the program as quickly as they could, again, because of the social stigma.
Right.
So that still very much exists today.
So yeah. Somebody in the chat put, and I was going to ask that question too. Mm-hmm. So, people who are, I'll say vaccine hesitant and also anti-vaccination, two different groups mm-hmm. of people, like look at that and say, well, look, vaccines go up and the rate of autism goes up. And therefore there's a correlation there. There's a
right.
causation there. And, that's problematic, because we still have people like Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is running for president who says that.
Yeah. Well, there's more to the story. So I'm about to go into the story that will actually give you the rest of the story. Excellent. So I'm gonna share my slide presentation. I don't use PowerPoint slides the way most people do. There's a long and complicated story behind that, but basically I hate it and I think it's stupid. So here is just my fancy slide, which is really just I typed stuff out on a PowerPoint template. I'm talented. So let's talk about language and identity again. We're going to talk about autism, autistic, and neurodiverse. These are autism and autistic means somebody who is obviously on the autism spectrum. Neurodiverse is a more generalized term, which includes certain other things like dyslexia, OCD, as well as ADHD, and a few other things, which I don't have written down. But basically, it's a broader term. For people whose cognitive processes are just very different than the what is considered normative, not to use the word normal. Neurotypical and autistic. Neurotypical is probably the most common one. Neurotypical is actually was actually created as a joke. Some people in the autism community decided to, as a kind of a project, to kind of point out some hypocrisies. As anyone who's been involved in disability rights knows, disabilities are not always, the difficulties disabled people have are not always due to their disability per se, but because the society does not have enough interest in allowing for the different abilities of certain people. And so what some people in the autistic community did was come up with this diagnosis called neurotypicality. And they gave it like a, what's the word I'm looking for? As a diagnostic criteria, a la the DSM. It's like, you know, thinking like, doesn't speak directly, you know, would rather speak in riddles, you know, hides their true their true intentions behind social norms, overly interested in socialization, you know, total lack of concentration on a fixed interest, you know, something like that. And so, but the term neurotypical has, so it started out as kind of making fun of non-autistic people, but it's kind of hung on because it is a useful catch-all term. For basically anybody not on the spectrum. Autistic basically is another word. It's not as common, but you'll hear it sometimes. And okay, so the next thing I want to talk about is two, what I'm going to call deprecated terms. One of which you will hear a lot still, and even I have used depending on where I'm talking, is Asperger's syndrome. In the 1940s, Hans Asperger had a clinic in Vienna where he was treating a group of children whom he termed, they were what we now call on the spectrum. And he was, originally it was thought that he was actually just trying to point out that these children have positive traits that balance out maybe some of the negative traits of being autistic. In reality, it's come out in the last couple of years that Hans Asperger, besides being a card-carrying Nazi, was actually just trying to extend the eugenics experiments to autistic kids. So yeah, his reputation was totally manufactured. And so because of this, a lot of people have just completely dropped Asperger's syndrome. The term itself comes from he published this paper. It was a relatively obscure German language journal. But by the time it was even published, the Allies had bombed the living daylights out of most of Vienna, including his clinic. And so it was not really heard from again until 1981, where a graduate nursing student in England named Lorna Wing picked up this paper and said, this is what I'm seeing in my practice here. She was a psychiatric nurse. And said, and so she said, you know, there's this probably this idea of a spectrum where they're not completely autistic, or I forget how she phrased it. There are people who have autistic traits. She goes, there's probably an entire spectrum of these children, she said. And the paper was entitled Asperger's Syndrome, and that's where the term came from. So Hans Asperger did not create the term. It was named after him because she discovered his paper. Autism spectrum disorder eventually made it into the DSM. I think it was the 3 at the time. Somebody here is a professional in mental health could probably correct me, but basically in 1988, it entered the DSM.
Where does the word autism come from?
It was originally coined by, and I don't remember the guy's name, but it was coined, it's from a Greek word. Autism basically means self-absorbed.
Ooh, ouch. I don't
well just know keeping if I care to the for that. Yeah, it's not it, I don't think it was actually meant as sort of demeaning, but then again, this was at a time period when words like idiot, imbecile, and moron were actually clinical terms.
You actually had like children's hospitals called Children's Hospital for the Feeble-Minded.
Yes. In fact, yeah. I just saw that interview. You interviewed Dr. Paul Offit today. Really enjoyed it.
Yeah, thank you. That's where I first heard that. It's like, yeah. Wow.
So yeah.
And when people get upset about like why we're putting so much effort into explaining these terms, that's why. Because yes. Otherwise we get that. So yeah, let's take exactly. A minute and think about the words. Words matter. Okay, off my soapbox. So, please continue.
Oh, not a problem. Not a problem. Believe me, I will be... I got a note for my soapbox in a little bit here. So in America, in the United States, Johns Hopkins University is a guy named Leo Kanner, K-A-N-N-E-R. He was the lead researcher in autism in the United States. And his basic premise was that if you were verbal, if you could speak, you were not autistic, full stop. He estimated that approximately 1 in 100,000 children max would be autistic. So, and he stuck with that for a really long time. And he started toward the end of his life, he did start realizing maybe he was wrong, started revising it, but it had been the standard for so long, still kind of coming back. So to go back to the question of why rates of autism seem to be going up, it's really because they were artificially deflated by a really, really bad set of ideas from an otherwise pretty decent doctor. He just got stuck on his own definition, and he just, you know, it was Johns Hopkins and it was Leo Kanner who basically absolutely had, you know, run of the roost, as it were. And so that's why it seems to be. So we started basically from below zero as far as like recognizing autism for what it was, a spectrum. So the question that often comes up is, why have a label? You know, when I got my diagnosis, well, you know, you were this way and now you have a label for it, but it doesn't change the way you are. Why even bother? I saw this the other day and I thought it pretty, because there's a comfort in knowing you're a normal zebra, not a strange horse. You can't find community with other zebras if you don't know where you belong. And because it's impossible for a zebra to be happy or healthy, spending its life feeling like a failed horse.
So, I love that so much.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. I don't do Twitter or X or whatever the hell they're calling it nowadays, but that's an awesome group. I would join that in a moment. OMG, I'm autistic AF. Is this okay? So let's discuss some myths, shall we? All autistic people are good at math. I will tell you right now, I love mathematics. I absolutely love it. I'm horrible at it. I get flustered very easily. I just give up. I curl up under the desk, feel like, no, I'm just terrible at math. I really am. There's this idea that all autistics have some special abilities. Oh, here's a poll question I should have put out. Hey, have y'all seen The Rain Man?
Rain Man.
Of course. Rain Man was actually based on a real person who was not autistic.
What was his issue?
He was originally a savant, but actually they recently found a new diagnosis for him, but it wasn't autism. It was a neurological disorder, but it happened to be one that gave him this fantastic memory for things and basically very much like a savant. Mm. However, when they made the movie, the director made the choice to make the character autistic as well. So that's where that came from. Yes. So Kim Peek is the guy who the character is based on, but he was not autistic, and he was never diagnosed as autistic. He was diagnosed as I said, savant. So there are autistic people with seemingly super abilities for various things. Calendar math is a big one. And things like that, memory for details, and of course the dreaded special interest, which we will talk about too, but where you get just obsessively compulsive about something for a really long period of time.
Yeah, his thing was he had to watch Wapner, People's Court, so he kept saying Wapner when it was getting close to the time, and he was very good with counting things almost instantaneously. I think like a matchbox.
Yeah, you could just see. Yeah, you just look at it and you can count without even. Yeah, using your fingers. Yeah, that does happen, obviously. However, I mean, a lot of autistic kids do not show any kind of a talent that makes up, you know, that for anything. What they do have is they have interests. They may not be especially good at them, but since it's a special interest, then they will spend untold hours doing these things, they will just naturally get good at them. So it's not a matter of something that magically produces some kind of amazing ability out of whole cloth. You know, in most people on the spectrum, it actually is built up over years and years. Those abilities, again, they may exist, but far more often it's just the result of, quite frankly, an obsession about a subject. Trains are very common. Vacuum cleaners are also very common. Which I found interesting because my grandmother told me a story about my dad who would take apart and reassemble successfully the vacuum cleaner in their house. And it would always work. But if she needed to vacuum the house when he had it apart, it was a bit of a struggle. So they ended up buying him his own broken vacuum cleaner so that he could take it apart. And he even got it working. So yeah, that's something. I highly suspect my father is autistic, but at this point, he's just turned 80, still alive, and just not interested in even, you know, just not even interested in, at his point, he's like, I'm 80 years old. What difference would it make? You know? So there is that. So let's talk a little bit about the next thing, some characteristics. Here's some memes I found that were posted on one of my autistic groups. As an autistic person, the thing I struggle to understand is that many people don't think as much. They don't analyze, they don't contemplate. In fact, they tell me to stop doing it. Just stop worrying, they say, as if not thinking will solve the issue. It drives me mad. And the next one, again, for the benefit of people who don't have the visual thing here, reading this thread, it seems fundamentally correct, but for a missed detail. It's not that they refuse to think, they being neurotypicals, although that is true. They think they're already come to the needed conclusions. They're already right, and challenging ideas is hitting internality. And then the last one I want to share with you of the meme space is, I hate it when they tell me to stop worrying. I am not worrying. I'm just thinking and trying to understand and working on issues because I want to, because I need to. I'm not happy if I don't understand something or if something doesn't seem logical. It is what it is my personal hell.
Oh my God, I'm on the spectrum. That's me. I could have written that every freaking day.
It is very true that, I'll give you a personal experience here. The worst thing that can happen to somebody who is on the spectrum is to have an unsolved problem go on forever and ever. Why did this happen? Especially in social situations, which we generally speaking, I probably should have said this at the beginning, not all autistics, okay? But for right now, this is a very common trait of social awkwardness and a not understanding of or processing of social cues, and significantly an impaired ability to give off proper social cues. An artist whom I'm friends with, who's actually done some work for me and I follow him, has a film that he's working on called Stuck in the Uncanny Valley, where he says that basically autistic people are like robots in that they're close enough to humans that they are recognizable, but they act so strangely that people who are not on the spectrum, or at least not used to people who are on the spectrum, tend to treat them as red flag factories. This person himself, his name is Nathan, he actually has been stopped by the cops multiple times, and he's an Irish guy. And the cop even told him once, hey, you were giving off a bunch of red flags. He says, I'm autistic, I am a red flag factory. You know, the thing about not making good eye contact or making too much eye contact, that could also arouse, you know, suspicions. If you don't make eye contact, people are kind of thinking, oh, they're being deceptive. If you make too much eye contact, it's like, oh, why are you staring at me? Is something wrong with this person? It's all just like awkward because we're trying to reason through things that most people just instinctively pick up because we are social animals.
Yeah, so some countries, like equivalent of the United States, is TSA. Do that, right? That they train their people to look at the people in the airport and try to make eye contact, and they judge them, I guess, on the neurotypical behavior. And if that doesn't fit, they'll pull them aside. So I'm wondering,
yep,
they're getting a lot of autistic people pulled aside, that not people who are, you know, terrorists.
And the social awkwardness plays into it too. My psychologist, the one who did my diagnosis, basically said he felt that a decent percentage of people who are in 12-step groups, AA or NA, are probably undiagnosed people on the spectrum because they get hooked on alcohol or drugs because it helps them to relax and socialize like they're expected to.
Ooh, is there any data on that?
I don't know. I've been asking him for a long time. I don't think there is, but he specializes in people on the spectrum. He talks all over the world. He's fantastic. And so that's what's happening. So that's the special abilities. So everybody has seen symbols of people with those symbols on the back of their car with the little puzzle piece with all the things on it, the little puzzle pieces, either rainbow puzzle piece. Well, you'll see it in just a second because I'm going to show it to you. We hate this. We hate that.
I don't think I've seen this.
This is the preferred symbol of the autistic community, the infinity symbol as a rainbow continuum. It's both neurodivergent and neurotypical people. It does not exclude people who are not on the spectrum. You know, it indicates that neurological differences are a natural occurrence of people. So We are not puzzles to be solved. We are not problems to be fixed.
I like this. Now, is this a symbol that people would put on their vehicle with the intention of signaling, like, to the police if they're pulled over to, hey, be aware someone in this vehicle may be someone who's neurodiverse in some way, and so to alert them to that to avoid a negative interaction?
Kara, that would be wonderful, but no.
Oh,
it's kind of viewed as, you know, people just look at it and just like the puzzle piece. Like, all right, one of his kids is autistic. You know, probably the same thing with the infinity symbol, since most people, especially outside the neurodiverse community, wouldn't even know what that meant. But people in the community, they have that done as tattoos and they have it all over their you know, stickers and things like that. So it's very much an in thing right now. It would be great, but I don't want to slam on law enforcement, but law enforcement has a long way to go before they get to that level of sophistication with recognizing really anything. So I'm just going to skip right past that. So
it's okay. I can speak on it. And you're right. There's a lot of work to be done. There's a lot of pseudoscience, I think, that goes into training for police based on mm-hmm. stereotypes that are not necessarily accurate. So I would love to see something like this as a way for people to kind of protect themselves a little bit.
For people who don't know, Kara, what's your background in law enforcement?
Yes, I have a background in law enforcement. I was a police officer for 10 years before I went back to graduate school. So there's training
on
things.
You're the heat, like, basically.
Yeah, fair enough. But no, I mean, there's, you know, I have a lot of friends who are cops, but that doesn't mean there's not a lot of problems. And, you know, the amount of training that you get for dealing with people who may be behaving in ways that are unexpected is inadequate. I'll just leave it at that. It is inadequate.
Yeah. Well, like Nathan said, you know, when they say you were giving off a lot of red flags, well, you know, maybe something. I think that'd be a great idea, Kara. That I think that's a fantastic idea.
Yeah.
Now I've got a cause. Okay, let me go on.
Yes.
Okay, so let me see. What is my next slide? We got to talk about this one. The blue puzzle piece. What organization is this? Anybody?
Is it Autism Speaks?
It is. We don't like Autism Speaks. And it's a shame because they are a fundraising powerhouse. Where does that money go? Not to autistic people. The actual amount of money that they spend out of their budget every year to actually help autistic people on the spectrum, adults anyway, is like zero. It's maybe 1 or 2% of their rather huge budget. They spend mostly on fundraising, they spend on marketing, and they do have some training materials, which are problematic. I'm not going to say too much about them because I will go on about this for a long time. But I will say two things. You see the way this is cracked? This is a t-shirt that's actually done by Nathan McConnell, the guy I was just talking to you about. The blue puzzle piece is specifically Autism Speaks. Now you ask yourself, why is it blue? Because when Autism Speaks actually adopted the symbol, it was believed that only boys could be autistic. In fact,
obviously, only boys are associated with the color blue.
Well, yeah, let that pass for right
so
now.
So I just looked up the Wikipedia article. It was founded in 2005. That recently, they thought only boys could. I don't know
what AS specifically believed, but it was initially already believed. In fact, even today, sometime before the pandemic, I actually was speaking to someone who moved from from Scotland to Canada. And in Scotland, her daughter was diagnosed as autistic. She got to Canada, they made her redo when she applied for the benefits that you get for being on the spectrum, the doctor in Canada said, you can't be autistic, you're not a boy, and took her, and she lost all of her support because of that.
Wow.
So there are still people out there who believe that. But it gets worse.
Oh.
And this next part is not Autism Speaks' fault, but it gets worse because just like many other things, autism is actually underdiagnosed in women and girls. Because what is normally what is considered abnormal for a boy will be seen as, oh, she's just a quiet girl. And so it's not seen as that unusual for a girl to be a little withdrawn, maybe a little bookish, maybe a little shy around people. That's okay. But for a boy, oh no, boys have to be out rough and tumble and playing and everything. If they're not, then it's noticed. So there's a couple, then there's more reasons than that, probably tying into the whole societal thing about why a lot of things are underdiagnosed in people presenting as female versus male, that sort of thing. So that's difficult to deal with. I will talk about some organizations that I do feel are worth supporting with your time and your money, if you feel like you should. And also just give, these are organizations which give good, really, really good information. Autism Speaks has a thing they call the 100-day kit. You have a child that's diagnosed with autism. They give you a 100-day kit for a price. I think it's $100, $150, something like that. It might be more now. And one of the exercises is to meet with your family, except the recently diagnosed autistic child, and talk about how wonderful your life was before the diagnosis, and basically how difficult it's going to be now that you have an autistic child. They have really played into the victimhood of the parents of autistic children. They have, either deliberately or not, they deny it. They deny it, but I'm not sure it's entirely true. They have amplified the anti-vax sentiment about vaccines causing autism. They have, I know for a fact, they have not taken a stance that say, no, this is not supported by the science. And there are no autistic people in positions of authority in Autism Speaks. So imagine, if you will, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People with no people of color in it. That's exactly what Autism Speaks. And that's why a lot of people, some people in the neurodiversity community, refer to Autism Speaks as a hate group. I think that's overselling it personally. I don't think they're a hate group. However, I do think they're wrong in so many terrible ways and detrimental ways to the autism community itself.
They also, at least initially, were on the forefront of saying that vaccines caused autism.
Yes. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, they were right there. They were right there. And their focus, they do about a quarter, 20 to 25% is geared towards research of their budget, but it's research into things like curing autism.
Ooh.
And preventing autism. And which, again, plays into the victimhood of the parents, which is not a helpful, it's not a helpful thing. I'm gonna tell another brief story. I was talking to my psychologist, and he specializes this, he sees children who are diagnosed all the time, and he meets with the parents and everything. And he says, sometimes after that initial meeting with the parents and a newly diagnosed child, he has this feeling that this kid's gonna be all right. His parents are supportive. They're interested in what they can do. They're going to do everything within their power to make sure that this child reaches their full potential. And there are other times when, after the meeting, he thinks to himself, these kids are fucked. That kid is so, so screwed right now, because the parents are just absolutely shut off to anything they would have to do. And unfortunately, this is the kind of mindset that is played into by groups like them. So, yeah, that's all I'm going to say about that. Like I said, I could go on forever. I don't think they're a hate group, but I don't like them for all of those and more reasons. So here's some organizations you can support. There is the Autism Women's Network. I believe it's a British-based organization. There's ASAN, the Autistic Self-Advocacy Network, which is a group that I belong to. It's an interesting group because it was founded by a guy who was just riding on a bus, I think in Boston, and there was a billboard, and it wasn't Autism Speaks, it was a college. This dear parent, we have your son. We will never let him go. Sincerely, Autism. And he said, no, this aggression shall not stand. So basically he formed the organization. 2 weeks later, they were already hit the iron ready to try to counter all of the negativity that crap like that spread. So yeah. Walk in Red, I actually don't know Walk in Red. But the phrase down below there is what I want to point out. Just like the rest, we absolutely agree with the disability community's slogan, nothing about us without us. And on that basis alone, Autism Speaks does not qualify. They did hire John Elder Robison, who is somebody I'll talk about later on, he's written several books. They had him on, and he lasted about 3 months before he quit in disgust, because they just wanted him there to say, oh, look, we have this famous autistic person on the board, but they wouldn't let him do anything. And he just left. And if you know anything about John Elder Robison, there's been a couple of specials and like profiles of him and stuff like that. He is not a person who holds his tongue, as many of us on the spectrum are. So,
what a strange irony that this organization is called Autism Speaks and has this slogan, "I can speak for myself," and it's literally opposite.
The "I can speak for myself" is the counter to that. That's why the puzzle piece. That's why the puzzle piece is broken in that.
Okay.
It's like we are smashing that puzzle piece. You know. Now.
Okay. So that's the response. Is no, right. Thank you. You don't.
Having
need to
speak said
for
that.
Me. Okay.
Having,
got it.
Having said that, I do want to make sure that it is very, very clear that there are people on the autism spectrum who cannot speak, even with assistive technology, and that's not what we're talking about. Those of us who can communicate have been ignored. And for instance, the unemployment rate among adults on the spectrum in the United States, depending on which study you look at, is anywhere from 65 to 85% consistently, regardless of economic times. Now, this is changing because there are companies who realize that, autistic people, they're really good at technology, aren't they? And so they absolutely suck. We all do. Many autistic people don't do well in a traditional interview environment situation. So some major companies, three of which have bases in Philadelphia: Microsoft, Comcast, and SAS, big worldwide software company. They have a special program for hiring people on the spectrum. And what they will do is they'll bring them in. First of all, they train the managers. This is how you deal with people on the spectrum. Give them the soft skills. At the same time, there's a 2-week pre-course that the applicants go through to teach them basic soft skills. You know, not trying to mold them into like your typical typical employee person, but giving them the skills that they can work on and deal effectively in the environment. Between that and the manager being trained, this creates a really good kind of, I hate the word synergy, but synergy, that's a good word that time. Then for 6 weeks, they're given a paid position with a team. Here's your team, here's your projects, go for it. If after 6 weeks they work out well, they get hired full time. And if they don't, they try them with another team. And it's been hugely successful. My doctor, who I spoke about earlier, he actually does the training of the people who train the managers to do this. So yeah, so the unemployment thing may be better. And the other nice thing about people who are on the spectrum, they tend to be super loyal. If they're happy in a job, they just won't leave, like ever. That's just something that happens. So there are encouraging signs. There are, you know, people like, I don't like change. Yes, that's kind of the thing. But that's all the slides I have. However, I've got many more to talk about. Yeah. I wanted to talk about religion. We are recovering from religion.
Yes,
where are we at
so
a time?
Excited
what,
for this.
What time did we start?
We started at about 20 after the hour. So
okay, so let me get through this in 20 minutes.
Yeah, 20 to 30 is fine. Yeah.
There is no research that I could find on the effect of autism on deconstruction. There is plenty of research on autism and autistic people's attitudes and experience within religions, but it's very broad based. And there's a lot of stuff in there that I am just not qualified to read or interpret. So I just gave up. And so I said, okay, here are some issues that I think will be problems for people who are in religions, particularly high control religions. Okay. Obviously from cult on down to like super conservatives to like just any high control situation. So what I wrote here is religion is theoretically about beliefs and principles, but realistically on a day-to-day level, it's about specific behaviors, programmed responses to situations, and empty platitudes. At least that's how it would seem to most adults on the spectrum. People on the spectrum can lie just as easily as everybody else. What people on the spectrum very often have a difficult time with is insincerity. of saying, I'm happy to see you if you're really not happy to see. There's an apocryphal story I have not been able to verify, but it's a great illustrative example. Nikola Tesla, who of course could not have been diagnosed as autistic, but many people speculate he very well might have been. Nikola Tesla has had an aunt, had two aunts, and they asked who was his favorite aunt, and he just blurted it out. So that's something that happens. So you end up doing something called masking. Masking is basically acting normal. The problem with that is that the way somebody on the spectrum who has a hard time reading cues will mask is they will take people around them, even television characters. I did television characters all the time as a child. And I would lift whole sections of dialogue and try to fit them into the situations that I was in. Because I'm like, oh, there's this person that seems really comfortable. So I take, I don't know, dialogue from Star Trek or H.R. Puffin stuff or whatever and try to work it into whatever conversation.
Okay, what Starfleet character were you?
Starfleet character, absolutely Spock. Absolutely Spock. I'm not the only person who loved Spock, although somebody I'll talk about briefly later on is Temple Grandin. Temple Grandin loved Spock, but when the Next Generation came out, her favorite character was Data, because Data had the same problems as Spock, but he was more wistful about his desire to be human. And that, to her, really, really got her in the feels, as it were. So
I love Temple Grandin. I'm so excited you're going to talk about her.
So basically, the problem with masking is, besides the stress that it puts on you, there's this always chance that you create this character and people like the character. So now you don't want to drop the character, but this person will never know what you're really like because you've just created this thing. It's just an image. You could lose your sense of self. You can have feelings of personal inadequacy. Well, I better keep this act up because obviously I'm not good enough. And you can also be accused of being kind of phony, especially if the mask cracks every now and then. For instance, if you're emotionally or sensorily overwhelmed, you will start to crack and you will start to be your very autistic self, even having a complete meltdown. Okay, autistic meltdowns are basically like losing your temper, except they're worse. There tends to be a lot of thrashing. It's where you get some self-harm going on. There was a play I saw recently that involved a nonverbal autistic character. Not totally nonverbal. He would repeat sayings. He could quote movies left and right, but he had to quote. It couldn't be anything that he actually said himself initially. He would always just pick it up. And at one point in the play, he is hitting himself saying, why can't you be normal? Why can't you be normal? Why can't you be normal? And in the beginning of the play, he is literally dumped into a junkyard from a car. And so and the woman who wrote the play, her son is nonverbal autistic and everything like that. The actor who played him is also autistic, was nonverbal when he was born, but learned to speak later. And so in fact, that's one of the most common symptoms of autism is that you start to learn how to speak, but about the same time you learn to speak, you then start losing the ability. And that's a telltale sign of that you may need a diagnosis. They have some very interesting diagnosis. They have eye tracking software. They can test infants as young as 6 months, where they will show them pictures of people and they track their eyes. And if their eyes don't track the eyes of the people on the screen, that's a sign of autism. They're not making eye contact with the pictures of people. They're focusing on everything but.
Huh. And so is the losing of the ability to speak, and this may be like too technical of a medical question, I don't know, but is that suspected to be because of this kind of disconnect with, like, why are we communicating this way? What is the purpose of this form of communication? It seems artificial somehow.
It's usually the pressure to mask that pushes it away. They also found that institutionalization is really bad, because if an autistic person has some kind of special ability, they will lose it if they're incarcerated. And when I say, and I use the word incarcerated almost as a Freudian slip, but it means institutionalized. So
yeah. Yeah.
Wow. There's also a general dislike of illogical or inconsistent rules. You can tell, I don't need to say anything about how that's going to play out in a high control religious situation. The hating insincerity thing, obviously. Also, but they can develop a special interest in religion and the Bible. And plenty of religions will be happy with that, up to a point. Until you start reading different versions, or maybe learning ancient Greek and realizing that things were mistranslated or changed over time, or parts of the Bible that nobody refers to and nobody, oh, well, that doesn't count. Well, why doesn't it count? And then we get back into the, you're not consistent, you're not logical. You say you believe the whole Bible, but you don't believe this part, or you think that that's, you know, oh, we can eat shrimp now. Yeah, but why are you still against gay people? Because it's like a couple of verses down from the shrimp thing. And so there's the, there is that. Basically, it, when will your special interest end? Never.
Oh, I can but, see how this would be so problematic in like a Sunday school setting for a kid that actually read the text and is bringing up these discrepancies.
Well, if anyone has ever seen the Big Bang prequel, young Sheldon, yes, he's definitely on the spectrum, and he memorized the Bible so he could win the Bible, you know, trivia questions, but he doesn't believe a bit of it. And he's constantly raising his hand in church. Wait a minute, I don't understand. How could all those animals fit on the boat? How do you believe that?
Yeah, exactly. Also, and one of the, I want to end with one of the last things that I want to end this part of the talk with the, one of the last things I noticed, which I think is far more interesting. In my work with RFR, one of the things that I find most tragic, now everybody who comes in here with, is, you know, who's ever had religious trauma, it's all tragic. But the thing that strikes me the closest to my heart is when I hear about people who have same-sex attraction or gender dysphoria, and they have nowhere to go because they belong in this religious group. The only therapists are religious therapists. Everybody, you know, we all know the story. But that's, but it gets worse. Among the autistic community, depending on the study, I thought there was no studies done on this because I knew anecdotally. In fact, I think, Rob, I even said to you at one point, I said to somebody, anecdotally, it seems to be there's a higher prevalence of gender issues and non-standard sexuality, like basic bisexuality, gender fluidity, that sort of thing among autistic people. That turns out to be really true. And it turns out since 2010, there has been quite a number of studies done on this. The prevalence of gender dysphoria or gender issues in general among the autistic community, depending on the study, is anywhere from 3 to 7 times higher than in the general population.
It's conversely, almost as if the rules that we place on people surrounding gender and sexuality are arbitrary.
Yeah, how about that? Also, the converse is also true. There is a much higher percentage of people who are on the autism spectrum who are gender fluid, non-sexual, bisexual, even celibate. Temple Grandin, again, when she hit menopause, she was happy. She had never had a relationship in her life. She was never married, never had kids. And her attitude toward menopause, she's like, well, I'm so glad. She goes, my sexual urges stopped when I hit menopause. And as far as I'm concerned, good riddance. To her, it was just a distraction. Like, why do I even need to deal with this? This is crap. So there's a lot of stuff out there. If you go out there, there's a lot of bad information. There's a lot of good information. So I have prepared a resources sheet, which I will post on the online community and with hyperlinks in a PDF that basically give a number of places that we can all, that people can go to actually get more information. That's good information. I may not agree with 100% of it, but it is at least good, mostly good information. And, you know, I could always be wrong. One of the things I want to tell everybody about here though, is there's one book. If I had the budget, I would give a copy of this book to everybody here who doesn't already have a copy. It's a book by Steve Silberman, who is a science reporter for Wired and other magazines. It's a big, thick book, but do not be afraid. It is very, very, very easy to read. It's a story. It reads very quickly, almost like a page turner. And it gives everything I've just told you, but much more. And it keeps it interesting throughout. It's called Neurotribes, and it is an amazing book. Absolutely. I'll post it here. Hang on. Let me blah, 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 blah. I'm going to give you the link. Now, the link I'm going to post in the chat is from a space called a website called Goodreads, because if you go there, they'll let you choose where you buy it from, rather than me just saying, here, buy this from Amazon, or here, buy this from wherever. It's like, you get it from wherever you try to get it. So that's the book. If you are new to this and you're very interested, maybe you yourself or someone you love, you suspect might be on the spectrum, this is a fantastic place to start. And it tells all of the stories. Now, one more I'm going to put up right now. And again, these will all be in the handout too that I give later. For an online forum, we were basically talking about having an autism community within the OC, and it just didn't seem like as good of an idea after I thought about it for a little bit, and a couple of us bandied the ideas about. However, the good news is there is an excellent online forum for those on the spectrum. And if you're self-diagnosed, that's totally cool too. You can go here. It's called wrongplanet.net. It has been active, I don't even remember how long it's been, but it's been at least the last 15 years or so. It's got resources, it's got all kinds of things. And another one, I'm gonna put on one more. There's an organization called GRASP. All of these organizations, by the way, are run by autistic people. GRASP is the Global Regional Autism Spectrum Partnership. And one of the things they do is, if you can't find the resources within your area, they do virtual assessments. So it's a little, there are plenty of places online. You can get self-assessment tests all over the place, but GRASP will actually give you an online assessment. Not an ideal situation for sure, but in the absence of anything else, it may just be what the doctor ordered. I've referred them to this particular, it's under resources on their main webpage. And they have other resources too. There are local chapters all over the place that meet. So there's groups that get together and discuss things. The play I mentioned was actually an outing that the local chapter of this group actually had. And it was a special, it was an autistic friendly performance. So there were actually two separate groups that were there. I'll tell you something, the actor who played the autistic character is just like, I have never had such an appreciative audience. And it was true. The entire audience got everything he was doing and everything that was written into it. And totally, I mean, bravo to the playwright for getting it right. Again, with her experience with her son, you know, is probably informed of that. And so these are great places to just start. I have some other books here. There are plenty of Temple Grandin, Thinking in Pictures, My Life with Autism. John Elder Robison, he's written a couple of books. Be Different, Adventures of a Free-Range Aspergian. You're still going to see Asperger's Syndrome and Aspie and things like that. If you're going to say Aspie, the term that's more acceptable now is called Audi. So just to get rid of that whole Hans Asperger, you know, stuff, you know, get rid of the stench of Nazism, you know, get that out of the way.
Yes, please.
And I've got a couple of YouTube channels, including there's one YouTube. Actually, this is a question that came up earlier. So what I'm going to do is there's a really, really good YouTube video that I have in this. It's by a psychiatrist, and he explains why autism and gender identity are connected. It's over an hour long, and he really goes it. It's on a channel called Healthy Gamer. And the guy who talks about it is a clinical psychiatrist. So, and because somebody asked this earlier, it might have even been you, Rob. This is for you, especially. Everybody can watch it, but yeah. Why is everyone suddenly neurodivergent? And this is a woman whose site is really good scientific information, not all specific to autism, but it's called, what's her name? Sabina Hassenfelder. And and she's really good. She's really good at explaining things, and she'll go into physics and stuff like that. But this was, I found this a very, very interesting video of hers because it attacks that specific thing. And I'll show you some of the other ones. And there's a lot of things on, you know, and there's also a video from somebody else. Is a British woman who does a thing called, her channel is called I'm Autistic, Now What? And she does one called What Does Masking Feel Like from the Inside? Nathan McConnell actually did a cartoon of a person tearing off a costume of normality from him with the caption, "The more you wear it, the more it eats you alive." And that's very much the internal experience of just not being able to go through life.
I watched one of the videos that somebody from this community, a woman who, you know, believes she's on the spectrum, and she said, "I have to tell you about masking," and I never heard the word. So she sent me a video from this channel, and I watched it. And this is proof that the algorithms work on these distribution networks, because for the next day, every single video I was suggested by YouTube was about masking. I watched one video.
You can imagine what my freaking you can weird. Imagine what my feed looks like now. <It's> like... at least the Christians have stopped bothering me, you know.
I get all the ads from Prager University.
and to address what a comment that I saw, Sabine had some transphobic leanings recently. I don't know that. I was really just looking at what's good content. I watched all these videos. What is good content? What is, you know, fair content? I didn't look into any other of their views one way or another. I mean, Richard Dawkins is a transphobe extraordinaire, but he's still got a lot of other good things about him. So let's, you know, pray for his soul or whatever the secular equivalent of that is, and things like that.
We'll think really hard about his soul.
Exactly. That's basically all I figured would fit into an hour, and I almost got it right. I'm here for questions if anybody has them. If I can't answer them, I'll just go check here. This is not me saying do your own research. This is me going, oh, that's a really good question. I'm going to look that up afterwards.
Thank you for that clarification. I love that. And we do have a bunch of questions, so that was excellent timing. We actually will have time for our questions, so thank you for that. Okay, let's see here. Rob, do you want to start us off with a question?
Yeah, I'm going to be selfish and ask the question I stuck into the list.
Go for it. That's why you get to be the co-host. It comes with privileges.
Thank you. It's with some privilege.
Are you one of those people that always wants to be the banker in Monopoly?
Oh, absolutely. I'm not going to trust anybody else to handle the money. I was going to ask this when you were talking about some, I guess it was Rain Man, and like, you know, that's a really old film. And I want to know what you think about some of the more current presentations of people on the spectrum. And specifically, I watched the series very recently, Extraordinary Attorney Wu. Have you seen that?
Nope. And I could tell you right now that if you're going to ask me if I've seen anything, you're barking up the wrong tree. I don't even own a broadcast TV. I do not watch anything except like streaming movies, and they're the ones I pick. I don't watch TV series. I just don't have the time. It's really funny. The irony is here is I've done movie soundtracks. I just had my first movie, the first movie that I had that had a public showing was a couple of months ago. It's a horror movie at the Salem Horror Fest. Fantastic. I don't like a lot of movies. I don't watch a ton of movies. And yet I write movie music. Go figure.
If that gives you a special ability to create because you're not like contaminated by having seen all of the popular things at the time, like you're able to think more organically.
It is interesting because one of the pieces of advice I got from a person who does a lot of movie and television soundtracks on, you know, if you want to get into writing movie soundtracks, don't listen to movie soundtracks. it may very well be that, you know, I'm not a Hans Zimmer or anything like that by any means, but you know, for whatever reason, it's just like, if I latch onto a movie, it becomes my special interest. And now that's my project. But anything else, I mean, I like movies. Don't get me wrong. I loved Interstellar. I'm looking forward. I want to see Barbie. I want to see Oppenheimer. I'm still iffy about Oppenheimer, but will I? Probably not. So yeah, do you have another question that doesn't have to do with movies or TV shows?
I would highly recommend that you watch that one though, if you're going to watch anything, because it is such a big hit that it is. I read the Wikipedia article recently, like 10 countries are optioning it to make TV shows in their country. It's a South Korean series.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, it's going to be made into a comic book strip and books. So it was really a hit. And the main character is a young attorney in her first job, and she is, you know, on the spectrum. So yeah, I can't answer. Yeah, I can't answer because you didn't see it.
Yeah, there's another series which I'm interested in. It's on my watch list and it's been there for years. It's called The A Word, and it stars Christopher Ecclestone, who, if you remember, was the original Doctor Who back in 2005 when it restarted 2004.
I know him. I was a speaker at Dragon Con, and they scheduled him to be opposite me. I wouldn't go see me if Chris Eccleston was talking somewhere at the same time. It was the first time he was ever speaking anywhere since he left the series.
Yeah, he had problems, that a lot of personal issues he didn't want to kind of expose and things like that. But anyway, the problem with the series is that it really focuses more on the family's dysfunctional reaction to the whole thing. Mm-hmm. So, you know, maybe not the greatest thing if you're somebody who's actually experienced that. So big trigger warning there. But anyway, that's one thing. The Good Doctor is another one I've never seen. I don't know.
Yes.
And I really hate the Big Bang Theory and everything about it. So to me, that's like not you know, I don't think that's a really good. I mean, I think I know they're playing it for laughs, and I know it's not meant to be an accurate representation of somebody who's autistic. But for some reason, it just I just don't find it funny. It's not offensive to me. It just this is just not funny. Then again, I didn't like Seinfeld either for the same reason. It just wasn't funny to me. So who knows? Although I will say, autistic humor can be very interesting. But anyway, any other?
A lot of questions, Kara.
Yeah. Try to get through these. Sorry.
Yeah. Oh no, you're fine. This is great. So let's see. We have so many questions. Let me pick another one. Okay. Here's one that I would like to know because I am also a big fan of Goodreads, and I'm so glad that you gave us a book recommendation in that platform so I could just add it directly to my want to read list. Another person is asking if you have any book recommendations on masking and or how to get better at not masking.
Ooh, I don't know, is the short answer to that. However, I'm getting all kinds of ideas. It's like, gee, maybe I should put together a library of autism resources and stuff like that. Actually, I would definitely go to like a place like Wrong Planet or something like that. And there's plenty of recommendations there from people who are on the spectrum. And I don't know of anything that is specific to masking, but like I said, one of the videos I'm posting is on there. And if Rob's experience is anything to go by, you will then be inundated with stuff about masking after watching one of those videos. So yeah, so that's so not specifically to that. But I will also plug my friend Nathan's channel on YouTube. I'm not on YouTube. Well, it is on YouTube too, but on Facebook it's called Growing Up Autie. He's done a number of t-shirts and artwork and comic books. And like I said, he's working on this animated film called Stuck in the Uncanny Valley. His name is Nathan McConnell. He's a great guy. Good graphic design. If you need graphic design, he does that. But also I was going to wear one of his t-shirts, but I decided to go for the button-down shirt idea. But one of his t-shirts says, "What is this neurotypical nonsense?" And there's another one that says, "Ask me about my oversharing." And I have another one. I actually have another one that I wear at work sometimes. It says, "Long story short, just kidding, I'm autistic."
Oh my goodness, this is great. Do you have a link for his site?
Yeah, hold on just a second. Yeah, this is he's on TeePublic. And I'll see if I can find a link to his Facebook page while the next question is being asked.
Okay, I am looking forward to it. And wow, that was fast. That came like immediately. Okay, I'm adding that to the list here. Okay, and what else, Rob? What other?
Well, questions? I want to ask this one because I just don't understand the question. So maybe it's phrased properly, and I just don't know. And Anthony, you'll know. I've been trying to get help with pragmatic skill development. I don't know what that means for 20 years, and therapists won't touch it. Any advice on pursuing this as an adult? Resources for adults. Again, I don't know what this means. With level one autism, are scarce.
I'm not familiar with the level one autism thing. It might not be. I don't
can't hear you. You're on your mic or something.
No, this thing does act weird occasionally. Is it better now?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
This headphone does have, every now and then it'll just fade for no reason.
Well, I have actually noticed watching you a few times. You put your hands up to your head and it always happened then.
Oh, okay. Maybe that's a tick that I'm unaware of. I am very ticky and I'm
aware. Ooh, there's a question on that.
Mm-hmm.
I think. Is a tick a stim?
Okay, let me answer this one question first.
One at a time, Rob.
Okay, let me come back to that.
Well, you led right into that one.
What was your question, Cara? What was the one you said to me?
I've been trying to get him a pragmatic.
Oh, pragmatics. Oh, okay, okay.
And therapists won't touch it. And then
well, here's the problem. Autism. Finding someone who is well-versed. I mean, a lot of doctors say, "Oh yeah, we deal with autism," and they don't really have a lot of experience in it. What I mentioned at the top of the talk is something called falling off a cliff. After you're 16, the services just go away. Now it is changing, but slowly. But it also depends on what area you're in. for instance, where I live outside of Philadelphia, Philadelphia has some really good autism resources because of the University of Pennsylvania Medical School and the psychiatric institutes that are there and everything like that. Drexel has a number of things, which is another, they're basically next door neighbors in Philadelphia. North Carolina has a very, very well-developed support system, which is weird. I mean, pardon my regional prejudice, but one does not think of North Carolina as a place that will have particularly good social services for something as off the wall as autism, but they do. If you're in the UK, there's the National Autistic Society, which publishes a monthly newsletter. You can subscribe for free. They'll email it to you wherever you are. Again, primarily in the UK, but it's still got a lot of good information. They'll put things about research and stuff that's going on, things like that. So I'll have to add that to my list because I forgot that. I mean, I could fill up volumes with just resources. I could probably come up with my own resources page a la Recovering from Religion. It'd probably be around the same size. It's unbelievable. And again, it's like somebody said, all of a sudden everybody's neurodiverse. I hope it's not fashion. I really don't. And Rob, your other question was about stimming. Is ticking stimming?
Yeah, so let me read the question the way it was put. It says, sure. If you don't mind sharing, if you're comfortable with telling us, what are your stims? And then I was just wondering if that's the same as a tick.
Okay, I'm going to answer the first question first, and then I'm going to say, I don't know, to the second question. I'm going to say, I don't know, but. My stims there are things that I'm completely unaware of. For a long time, I would do this, right? Or something like this. And I was totally unaware of it. One time I was working in an office and they were all doing it around me and laughing. And I was like, what did my coworkers? And I was just like, what? They're like, you don't know. I'm like, no, I don't know. Like, you don't know you do this. I'm like, no, do I? They're like, no. So that, you know, but that's gone away. Actually, that went away about 10, 11 years ago. I don't know what started it. I don't know why.
Was realizing that you did it partly how you were able to stop it?
No, because it stayed for like at least 10 years after that. Oh. So, but having pointed it out to me, the only reason why I even knew it was still there was because my wife, who she and I got back together again about 13 years ago, she pointed it out to me. And I'm like, I'm still doing that? I still had no idea, yeah, even though it was pointed out to me.
By the way, for the people who only get the audio version of this, say, what were you doing?
Throwing my right arm into the air and then letting it flop down back at my side. Another stim that I have that I still have to this day is uttering random phrases, you know, like, well, even if nobody's talking to me, it's a way of clearing an intrusive thought. I don't know why it works. I don't know anything about the mechanism behind it. I just know it works for me. Is a tick a stim? From the outside, I would say they're probably indistinguishable. The only difference is stims tend to be very long, you know, like if I were flapping, right, which is the flapping of the arms, which is most commonly associated with autistic behavior, or hitting your head against something, like banging your head against the wall. And sometimes they tend to be longer. They, you know, tics, I think, tend to be like one-time things. They're like, you know, or you know, kind of repetitive motions. But I don't know at the basis of them. Do they have the same basis? What are they? I don't even know that. But I do know that from the outside, they would absolutely do look like tics.
So. Yeah, there was a kind of an associated question, and maybe you can't answer it, but I might as well get it out. Someone in the chat put, can you define a tick, which sounds like you're not sure, but she went on to say, I do this like super repetitive thing with my fingers sometimes, and I don't like it. It's kind of frustrating, but I feel like I don't have another choice.
Well, a good suggestion. There's a whole cottage industry of fidget toys and handling things that, which is even jewelry that you can wear that is also a fidget.
I have one.
But not just the fidget spinners, but there is jewelry that you can actually squeeze or even chew on or something like that, just so you have it near you so that if you feel the need to stim, you can do so in a way that's not going to like get people, you know, that's discreet. These are also places you can find weighted blankets are also very often loved. Temple Grandin, as a girl, invented her own hug machine. where she a cattle gate where the young calves were being trapped so they could only go through the gate one at a time. She adopted it, put it in her room. If she felt like she was getting overwhelmed, she made a remote control and adapted it to fit her. And so she would press it so that she'd feel the pressure on both sides of her body, and that would immediately calm her down. There was a movie, Claire Danes stars as Temple Grandin. There's a biopic about her. I don't know how accurate it is, but Temple did say she liked it. So, you know, it's like, that's the ultimate thing.
Yeah. I love that. I'm going to see.
Oh yeah. Rocking is a stim. Somebody did say, yeah, rocking is a stim. I also have a leg that won't stop, and it's been that way since I was a kid. It's just my right leg. It's just constantly going. It goes slower when I'm more tired and faster when I'm more energetic. That's the only thing. I don't know. Is it a tick? Is it a stim? Is it restless leg syndrome? I don't think it's restless leg syndrome because it does go away when I'm asleep. So
this is interesting because as you're saying that, my leg is going up and down here for no good reason.
Join us, Rob. Don't be afraid.
Ooh, exciting. Rob is going to have news for us next week.
Why are we actually, this has been my whole life, and I looked up restless leg syndrome at one point and I didn't think it quite fit. So I don't know.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
Okay.
Well, we have more questions, and here's one that's kind of along the same line of questioning we're going down. This is also a personal question. So of course, you know, feel free, you know, sharing as much as you want to share and not sharing whatever you don't want to,
of course,
we are on the interwebs. So someone is asking, what led to your wife asking if you've ever been tested for autism? Were there certain common behaviors that she learned about from Gary Newman's wife that she saw you do the same thing, or what was going on there?
Yeah, basically it had to do with in my mind, and this is kind of also a little bit of self-reporting on all my life I have been non-gender conforming. Okay. Yeah. Probably as a result of the autism, but who knows? But I never felt the need. I never felt the need or anything to give myself the label of queer, because it really didn't just. It really. I mean, first of all, everybody else was calling me it already. So, and that's not a joke. But one of the things is I would just blurt things out that I would think had no emotional valence whatsoever, and they would really upset my wife. And she was wondering, why does he keep doing this? Because I would talk about, you know, people, and she gets a little wary when I talk about other women. And to me, gender is just a piece of data about that person, you know, but to her, it is loaded with emotionality and stuff. And in her quest to like, why do you do that? I think she was reading something where Gemma was describing her brother who does this, and his wife had a problem with it and everything. And it turns out he was diagnosed. So that was kind of like stuff like that was kind of, you know. Other people have certainly noticed these behaviors in me. I can come across as very arrogant and rude. I can come across as very dismissive of people's feelings, and you know, especially if I'm in kind of a focused mode. But
every professor and TA I ever had was then autistic.
There you go.
Because they're all freaking like that.
Yeah. But the plus I'm in IT. Come on.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, there is a right before the Spectrum came out, there was a book that was published in, and they talk about this in NeuroTribes. There was a book called it Silicon Valley Syndrome. And it was all these women talking about how their husbands were just like these totally out of touch, non-socially adept kind of people, but geniuses all the same, but just had no social skills whatsoever. And if you read it, they said, this could have been the description of somebody on the autism spectrum, but it was published before the autism spectrum was actually a thing. As I said, when the autism spectrum became a thing in 1988, I was 25 years old. I was 1 year from leaving the military, and I was way too old to get any kind of resources for autistic kids because I was past that terrible age of 16. So it's like, oh, you're an adult now, you're fine. So yeah. So to answer that question, that was basically it. It was why she thought, you know, it was a contradiction to her because she said, you know, she obviously saw that I cared for her and I loved her, but she didn't understand why I would do these other things with her, which hurt her, and couldn't understand why it hurt her. Because that's what I was doing. I was trying to understand. No, explain to me why. Because you mentioned it. No, but why did that hurt you? It was just like this kind of circular thing. And then she realized, wait, he doesn't even know what I'm asking. He doesn't know. Because to him, it doesn't mean anything. you know, it's just data. That's my my phrase. It's just data. You know, so that's kind of the abbreviated version of what about what that happened there. So we weren't like on the rocks or anything like that. It was you know, a really kind of a dark section of an otherwise really good relationship. So understand, my wife and I have actually known each other since we were 11. Well, I was 11, she was 12. And so she was able to actually help with the diagnosis because she remembered me all those years ago. So.
Wow, that's kind of handy.
Wow.
And my mom was still alive and is still alive, and she was still alive at the time and had a pretty good memory about a lot of stuff too. So we all filled out surveys, and apparently we all filled them out within 2 points of each other without consulting. So that helped with the diagnosis. Yeah.
High inter-rater reliability.
Exactly.
That's great. Okay, so I've got a question here for you. You mentioned that you were diagnosed later in life with autism, and correct, that was presumably after you had deconverted and deconstructed from religion, right?
Mostly, yes, yes.
Okay, so let
me just say, my own deconversion was kind of long, and really I had deconverted many years before even realizing it. The biggest thing for me was actually calling myself an atheist, because I for some reason resisted that for a really long time. But so in essence, I had lost most of my beliefs in anything, you know, quite a while before that. So
okay, so then kind of the follow-up question is, did getting that diagnosis kind of provide any kind of aha moment or sort of explanation for why things you had experienced had been the way they were? Or did it help you kind of make sense of that experience in any different ways? And if so, how?
Okay, I mentioned this earlier. Remember I said earlier in the talk about how the worst thing an autistic person could actually have is an unsolved puzzle. So why did this happen? Why did this person treat me this way? Hundreds, maybe thousands of instances all along my life were just spinning, unsolved, unknown in the back of my head. You know, because your brain's kind of processing things whether you're thinking about them consciously or not. At least I believe that. When I got the diagnosis, it was as if all of the alarms went off at the same time. And it's like, make sense of this, make sense of that. Oh my God, that's what, and that too, and that. It, not all of them, but it gave me a new lens to look at it, and suddenly it made more sense. Now, the problem with this was that essentially I was having multiple very unpleasant involuntary memories of stuff that had happened to me throughout my life, very painful memories all at once. And I was thrown into about a 2-year depression after that. So it was an aha moment, but then there was dealing with the aftermath. Finally, it's like there's this thing, and it's just like, and, you know, I came out the other side of it just fine, but, you know, as far as I could tell. But the real benefit, besides making sense of your past, is that you make sense of it. The downside of it is people who think you go on about the past too much will not be happy around you as you start to say, oh, and remember when this happened, you know, that sort of thing. But moving forward, now I can understand, and I can actually avoid situations. And by the way, not blame myself because somebody else didn't like me, and not take the fault on as myself. So yeah, it definitely, I mean, I highly recommend it. I go back to that, what I said on that slide. It's like, it's just good to know that you're a zebra and not a failed horse, you know? So I think that's a good thing.
And
if the services are available in your area, that's great, but it's certainly necessary. I got so many phone calls from companies, because not only am I, now that I'm on the spectrum, I come under the disabled workers kind of thing, and I'm a veteran. So all of a sudden people were calling me, say, hey, would you like to apply for one of our jobs? Just like, and I had just landed a really good job at that time too. And it was just like, oh, I just got one. Sorry. It would have been nice to have a bigger choice, but that just happens sometimes.
That's great. Well, if you decide you don't like it, you can change, but I.
Well, no, I love the company I work for right now. It's family owned and operated. The family all get along with each other. It's a really close knit group. I love it. I think if I could be paid significantly more, and I still wouldn't have as good of a time as I'm having at this company. So I was very, very lucky. I mean, one of the things about the unemployment thing is I since I left the military, this is my 17th job. Wow. I interview very well, but I have a very hard time because if layoffs come, you're usually the first target because you're the unusual one. You're the one that doesn't quite fit in, you know, or, you know, and very often the problem child too, because you're the one that's always questioning things. And if your culture, if your work culture doesn't appreciate that, that can be a problem.
Oh my God, that was the thing with my mother to me. She couldn't understand why I asked so many questions.
Yes.
That thing about don't think about my mom all the time. Why don't you just accept things the way they are? Why can't you just don't think, just don't worry about what it all means. Just get on with your life. I'm just like,
Oh, the thing that drove me the most bonkers when I was younger was whenever we would have a question about the Bible teaching or whatever it was, the thing we weren't supposed to do or say or think, the answer was always, you don't have to understand it, just accept it. Mm. No, I do have to understand it. It does not work.
Absolutely, yeah. And it, yeah, and exactly. So yeah, that, and that's and again, that doesn't play well with most religions. And again, the more high control there is, there's a doctor who, by the way, I want to give a special shout out to. I don't know if they're here tonight. One of the people who shows up regularly at the virtual hangout has her own YouTube channel called Vanessa Marie Books. Anyway, she goes to the hangout. She was just coming up with resources. Like I got a lot of these from her, especially the videos.
And one of them was
on the religious experiences of autistic people by a guy who has a YouTube channel called Neurodivergent Doctor. And yeah, he's a doctor and yeah, he's on the spectrum, but I think he's a psychologist. I don't think he's a medical doctor, but he, basically, the video is more about how a church or a congregation can make their services more friendly for people on the spectrum. They aren't really about the autistic experience of religion itself. And I can see where it'd be useful, again, if there's a religion that's not super high controlling and stuff like that. But yeah, that's not that. It, what seemed like a really promising thing, but his channel actually has some very good information on it otherwise. But it's just nothing for this particular talk. So,
oh, that's okay. Yeah, that's awesome, and we love
Brianna. Absolutely love what you just wrote. I love to respond to those people. Give me $500. Why? You don't have to understand it; just accept it. That's perfect.
I love it. All right. Well, we probably have time for maybe one more question. Rob, do you have a good one?
Puppy break. Well,
maybe. What's that?
Yay!
I can't see her very well. Yeah.
I love it.
She just came down here. She was like, you've been away for a really long time.
why are you in the basement?
Yeah.
All right. So maybe this can wrap it up. Someone asked, what's an effective way to explain to neurotypical people how people with autism feel empathy in light of theory of mind issues?
Okay. This is a good one. I actually took this out of the talk and okay. There is this idea that I'm going to call wrong. I don't know where the science is on it yet, but I'm pretty sure it's wrong. One of the people who promotes this idea is a guy named Simon Baron Cohen, cousin of Sacha Baron Cohen. Oh. He's a clinical psychologist in England, and he's written some very good papers on autism. Unfortunately, he subscribes to the model that it marks a lack of empathy, and so he puts autism in the same category as borderline personality disorder, antisocial personality disorder, and narcissistic personality disorder. This is wrong. And people on the spectrum who can speak and who can communicate have said this many, many times. It is not that we do not feel empathy. We feel too much emotion, too much empathy. We are overwhelmed by it. However, in the expression of that empathy is difficult because the expression of emotions is something we're not very good at. So we feel the emotion, but we don't know how to properly express it in a way that's acceptable to the person that maybe feels it. Yeah, so Glenda, yeah, it's literally, I'm so empathetic, it makes life considerably difficult, man. I know I'm not alone. No, you are not alone. And that's what happens. So yeah, there is very, very high empathy. And then you will have, But again, it's the communication aspect. It's the there's a term for it. I think it's demonstrative versus intuitive or something like that. So I mean, people on the spectrum can learn how to navigate social situations very well. I'm really good at social situations until something happens that I didn't expect and I have to go off script. Then it's kind of a crapshoot. What's going to happen next? I often say I don't know what I'm going to say until well after I've said it. So that's basically the answer to that. It's still, even though people say, oh, but you seem so normal, which is aggravating, like you wouldn't believe. But all of this is very practiced. It's still an intellectual process. I have to do this because of that. It's all very logical. And I can get very good and very practiced at it, but it's still an intellectual process. It's not something intuitive. So that again plays into how the empathy can sometimes get really messed up. I would say that if you want to try to learn that, sometimes, depending on what your feeling is, I've heard that dialectical behavioral therapy, which ironically is used for people with borderline personality disorder, sometimes that can help. But I don't know of any specific modalities for it. As I said, I'm not a clinician, and I really haven't even delved into that particular kind of rabbit hole. My own psychologist basically used CBT, and I seemed to respond very well to it. And also volunteering for Recovering from Religion has absolutely helped. The training is instant plug here, but the training that I got, I did it deliberately because I knew that I thought I'd be terrible at this. And I'm like, oh, if I can, and everybody said the same thing. They were very encouraging and it has helped. And it has helped me to develop my communication skills. So I'm not lost for words and just trying to express normal concern and emotions and empathy toward people who are going through some terrible suffering. But it's not just RFR, but it's, just kind of making a concerted effort to do that. Not in a way that goes into masking, which is pretending that you do this, but actually learning how to do it for yourself. And not everybody has that ability. Some people, the edges are there and you just have to find people who accept you with the jagged edges.
Man, I love that. I love how you put that in. I am going to second your plugging of the volunteer training here at RFR. I actually did a master's degree in dispute resolution and conflict management before this, because I have never been diagnosed with autism or anything like that, but I do identify with what you're describing about having a lot of empathy, but like not knowing how to go off script. And I loved your quote. I don't know what I'm going to say until well after I've said it in those situations. Yeah, it's bad. And so I went to school because that's how I solve problems. I go to school and get a degree in whatever the thing is I don't understand. So I got a degree in that because I hoped it would help me with the feels. And anyway, long story short, the training that you do at RFR to volunteer here is basically the same thing you could pay a lot of money to go get a graduate degree in. So it's good.
And Glenda, thank you for bringing this up. CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy. You may want to be careful if you're going to Google just CBT. I'm just saying.
Not on your work computer.
Just
now you're going to make me Google it to see what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Oh, no, Rob.
I was having
share your screen.
Another flashback, 1986, on a cruise. You sit with the same people at dinner. One person was somebody who owned his own engineering company. And basically, after the 7 days were over, he came over to me and said, if you ever move to whatever state it was, somewhere in New England, I'd like to offer you a job. And he said, you're very good at social interactions for an engineer. So I was like, I never thought more of it than just as an engineer part.
Yeah, I mean, and it's true. John Elder Robison has some great stories. He is a self-taught engineer. If you're aware, if you've seen the video of Kiss from back in the 80s with the guitar that actually had the lights on it that like moved while Ace Frehley was playing the guitar, he designed that and built it himself. He designed the pyrotechnics on Kiss's guitars, the ones that blew up when you play them or lay them on the side and stuff like that. He designed electronic stuff and he is completely self-taught. So, again, it's a special interest and he just just went ahead and did it. You know, he's probably invented the phrase, I didn't know it was impossible when I did it. Mm-hmm. I think you're muted, Kara.
Yes, I was. I was typing, and I have noticed on this computer that the typing is very, very loud. So I mute myself while I'm typing so it doesn't overtake the audio. So that's what was happening there. Sorry about that.
That's fine. Yes. I actually just recently changed my keyboard because my other one was too loud. And I wanted to be able to type during boring Zoom meetings without muting and making it obvious that I wasn't paying attention.
Yeah, I'm typing right now. Can you hear it?
No.
Nope. Yeah, see, silent keyboard. Very good.
Wow. Mine is very clacky. So, which Excuse I kind me. Of like, I enjoy that. It's very satisfying while I'm typing for it to be like, click, 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 click.
Well, the other thing I want to say before I close is that thank you everybody for coming to this and for listening to me ramble. And I am on the OC. You will see me as M.E. for my handle, Maurice Escargot. People who are big fans of Alice Cooper might remember that name. So, if you have any more questions, I mean, I will share these resources on the online community. I don't know where, Kara. I suppose you'll tell me where. So,
yes, yeah. If you want to just send them to me, and we can figure out how to distribute them, and we can also put them in the show notes when this goes to YouTube. We'll have them there as well in the podcast, and also mm-hmm. we can have them if people want to email us and ask for them. We can do it that way, where they just email at rfrx@recoveringfromreligion.org, and we send them out there, or we can put them in the announcements page, probably, if you'd like to do that.
Someone in the chat asked about what the OC was, by the way. So we talked about that in the beginning.
Online community.
They may have not been here for the whole thing. So yeah, okay. that's our online community that you cannot find. It's the only thing that we offer that you cannot find on the recoveringfromreligion.org webpage. You need to call in or chat to become a member.
Yeah. And I will also give me a day or two to finish up, because I've got a lot of notes here and some more ideas for things I want to include in it. So I'll try to keep it to 2 pages, you know, but they will include all hyperlinks where they're available. So.
Excellent. Thank you so much. Yeah, I love that. Thank you for putting that together and making those resources available for people. I think that is really helpful. And judging by the number of people that answered yes in our initial poll of whether they or someone they know has been diagnosed with autism, I think those resources will be very, very relevant, because it was the majority of the people here this evening.
Yeah, I did notice that. That's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's great. And thank you again for sharing all of this information with us. This was fantastic.
Recovering from Religion is a nonprofit organization whose mission it is to provide hope, healing, and support to those struggling with issues of doubt and non-belief. Hope, healing, and support is waiting for you on our website, recoveringfromreligion.org. There you can speak or chat with a trained agent who will work with you through your struggles and doubts, or to help find resources that may work for you. You can also find local Recovering from Religion support groups in your area for the long-term recovery work. Resources specifically curated for those struggling with doubts, disbelief, and trauma can also be found on the RFR website. To connect with a secular therapist in your area, go to seculartherapy.org and create an account. If you'd like to support the work that RFR does, you can donate or sign up as a volunteer on the Recovering from Religion website. It's also a big help subscribing to the RFR YouTube channel, our blog, or following us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Questions, comments, and suggestions can be emailed to us at rfrx@recoveringfromreligion.org. Thanks for tuning in, and we hope you'll be with us next time on the Recovering from Religion podcast.